It was an unknown wilderness. It wasn't long before they went into the wide valleys of Kentucky through the Cumberland Gap.
Welcome to this edition of Old Kentucky Tales, the only podcast that solemnly swears that none of its participants have ever claimed that butter is our most valuable source of energy. That is right, isn't it, Jason? Have you ever made that claim?
No, but I've thought a lot about butter. Butter's good.
It is, but I think we're still covered. Today's title is The Great War's Great Food Obsession. I am your host, Brent Taylor, Assistant Professor of History at West Kentucky Community and Technical College. And with me is the man who once contemplated inventing his own award called the Muni for his own lifetime achievement in communication. He is an associate professor of communication at West Kentucky Community and Technical College, Jason Donner.
First the butter, now the Muni.
Yeah.
What does that mean? What's the Muni?
I think the Muni is when you've been really good in the field of communication for a very long period of time.
Oh.
And then you receive that award.
That's why I haven't heard of it. Yeah. Gotcha. The Muni.
The Muni. And along the way, don't forget to support the fake history sponsors who support Old Kentucky Tales. In this episode, we will look at the words of Henry Clay in our Rock the Quote segment. And for our main event, we will examine World War I's incredible obsession with food.
I like these episodes about food.
Yeah, they make
Food's
you really
fun.
Hungry right
yeah,
before
it
lunchtime.
Does.
We are ready for our Rock the Quote segment. This is a brand new segment in which we look at a really old quote and see if we can make anything out of it. So today's quote is from Henry Clay, "I'd rather be right than president."
Right. Yeah. There has to be a background story to that. What happened that made him bring that up?
Well, the background story to this is he was a multiple time entry into the presidential sweepstakes.
Right.
So cycle after cycle after cycle, Henry Clay's there. He ran for president in the 20s, 1820s.
Mm-hmm.
He ran for president in the 1830s. He ran for president in the 1840s.
I mean, that's a name that, you know, you learn in the history class, Henry Clay, important figure.
Yeah.
Why couldn't he win, though? What was the problem?
The problem with him seems to be that he's from a border state, which is Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
The people in the North did not 100% trust him on certain issues. And then also the people in the South didn't 100% trust him. We know him as the great compromiser.
Mm-hmm.
So he's the guy getting everybody to agree to deals. And if you start getting into the extremist politics of some of the sections of the country, then the problem is, well, if you're in the North, well, why is this guy so in favor of the slave people? And then if you get into the South, they're like, why is this guy have some kind of a problem with slavery?
Yeah, isn't that? That's a funny kind of dichotomy that he was into.
Yeah.
Being in that position, a compromiser, but when it came down to voting for the leader, people didn't like it.
No. They want that strong stance where you know where they stand exactly. And that wasn't it in the presidential politics.
Yeah.
He got really close one time. There were several times that he was really not very close.
Was he ever vice president? I mean, how high up did he get?
I would suppose that his greatest position was as Speaker of the House.
Okay.
But he was also a senator. That's a pretty privileged position, too.
Right.
Not so many of those. Less than 100 at that time. He was Secretary of State at one point. He had every job except
Secretary
Vice
of
President
State.
Or President.
Right. So it made sense for him to run. He kept trying anyway.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He tried over and over. And I think that's the nature of the quote is just kind of bitter there at the end. And so I'd rather be right than president.
Yeah. It's kind of like, hey, I'm still good.
Yeah. Yeah. It wasn't me. It was them.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're 100% right about that. But already, we've got to pay some bills around here and have the first word from our sponsors.
Kettle's Home Beer and Museums. You know what calomel is. It's mercury, quicksilver. Calomel is dangerous. It crashes into sour bile like dynamite, cramping and sickening you. Calomel attacks the bones and should never be put into your system. Take Dotson's Liver Tone instead. When you feel bilious, sluggish, constipated, and all knocked out and believe you need a dose of dangerous calomel, just remember that your druggist sells for a few cents a large bottle of Dotson's Liver Tone, which is entirely vegetable and pleasant to take, and a perfect substitute for calomel. It is guaranteed to start your liver without stirring you up inside. Don't take calomel. It makes you sick the next day. It loses you a day's work. Dotson's Liver Tone straightens you right up and you feel great. Give it to the children because it's perfectly harmless and doesn't gripe.
Can you believe this one, Jason?
Yeah. Back then, they just took everything, right?
And this
is kind of a cool ad because it's saying this stuff you've been using, not good.
Yeah, not good at all because it's mercury.
Right.
Highly poisonous.
It says this other product, dangerous.
Yeah. And then this one too. I mean, I still wonder about how exactly it's going to work for you. They had this obsession back then with your liver and your kidneys. And if you could just get your liver and your kidneys working right, then pretty soon everything else falls into place.
Yeah, it kind of says it'll start your liver without stirring up your inside. Yeah.
Anything's got to be better than mercury, though.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, that at least they kind of knew that some of this stuff wasn't good for you.
That's the thing about the 19th century and the early 20th century. They are coming around to the fact that certain things work, certain things don't work, but it's still a really imperfect understanding of it.
And I guess you got to try things out, though, to figure that out on people, right? You got to try it out on a few folks.
Trial and error.
Right.
Not bad in the medicine industry back then. As for us, though, we need to move on to our main event, and that is World War I's food obsession.
Mm-hmm.
The Great War's great food obsession. I don't know if you were aware of this or not, because it's not the political history and it's not the military history. Behind the scenes at home in a place like Kentucky, and all these things came out of Kentucky newspapers, of course, there's an obsession with food. We are wanting to save food for our soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to feed the starving people of Belgium, who are the refugees of World War I. There still needs to be plenty of food for people to eat at home. So everything is about the food.
So these are advertisements trying to get people to change what they eat, how they eat.
Yeah, and some of it's also government-driven, too, because we have a brand new thing. It's kind of the War Cabinet. And different components of the War Cabinet are trying to help maximize efficiency and production during World War I because they realize that it's the largest war in history to that period, to that point. So one of the new legs or arms of the government at that point is the U.S. Food Administration. And the entire goal of the U.S. Food Administration is to increase food production and to actually help regulate your consumption of food, to get you eating different kinds of food, alternatives, and we're going to be saving things like wheat and sugar for the army. And the idea is that we're going to ship it over there to Europe.
Right, yeah.
They can fight the war using those calories. You're going to have different kinds of calories, and you're going to cut back here at home.
Yeah, people think about sacrifices during these wars in terms of like using rubber or metal. But food was a big part of it, too.
Food is a huge part of this war and World War II. But it seems to be especially prominent in World War I. If we look, we can see an ad here from the papers. And it says, food savings of millions of Americans during our first year of war enabled this government to send enormous food shipments abroad for our fighting forces and the Allied nations. And they say cereal. 154 million bushels saved because of these efforts.
Mm-hmm.
That's a whole lot that you could ship over there to the war effort. The fat shipments, 844 million pounds. And they referred to this as America's box from home. It's like a care package for the soldiers.
Right. So this is something you could do. This is something you could do to help out.
Yeah. And there's a special term for that in World War I called doing your bit.
Really?
And this is doing
like
your
slogan.
Bit.
Yeah.
It's exactly. It's a catchphrase. 100% right.
And so they can't see this, of course, but there's a little cartoon of the soldiers celebrating when they get their flour and their sugar and just, I guess, their meat and their fat.
Yeah, because we're taking care of them.
Right.
And that's doing our bit
for
sure. We also
You've got ads everywhere all over here.
Oh, we've got
all different kinds of things.
And that's because they're in every single paper, every single day throughout that entire war period. That's the 19-teens when you're talking World War I.
Mm-hmm.
We've got this next thing. I like how this does it. It's taking a little bit of U.S. Department of Agriculture knowledge, and it's turning it into something that you can see, a message for you. So this is claiming that wheat flour is the cheapest and best food, that you're going to get more energy per 10 cents. That's an interesting kind of thing.
Right. I see it's got all the, it compares it to milk and pork and cheese.
Yeah. Yeah. And so
how much
eggs,
energy
of course,
you get from right. 10 cents.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's an interesting kind of, it's like miles per gallon, except
right.
except it's calories per 10 cents.
Again, trying to convince you, hey, eat this. Your 10 cents will go a lot further.
Yeah. Of course it is. And it's helping the war effort.
Mm-hmm.
But it makes me not want to eat wheat flour. This is making me want to go low carb, Jason. It's telling me,
well,
look,
it makes sense. It's carbs.
This is, you're getting the most bang for your buck here for calories.
All right.
But maybe in this case, I want to go for the beef and the eggs, which are down at the bottom of the list.
That's the bottom of the list. Yeah, mutton, yeah. Sirloin. I don't know how many people are eating sirloin back then anyway, right?
That's a good question. Probably not that many.
I don't know if they thought in those terms even, but like we think of as meat and just different flours, carbs. But if you look at the list, it's actually backwards appropriate. You got eggs and meat at the top and butter, rice, potatoes, all your carbs at the high energy end.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Rice, potatoes, beans, wheat flour. Those are the ones at the top of the list. That is true. In our next thing that we are going to discuss, we see here that...
Savings, big savings. Oh, uh-huh. They're comparing like what you could eat. Instead of eat meat, eat fish, eat beans.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. These are some of the alternatives. Instead of wheat, corn. Instead of sugar, use syrups.
Mm-hmm.
And there's actually some recipes back then called war bread, where you're supposed to be cutting the sugar out and you're using some of these alternatives.
Right.
And if you look very closely down at the bottom, you will see that
is,
this
yeah.
message is brought to you by the U.S. Food Administration.
Yeah.
That was Herbert Hoover's job.
Really?
And that's actually, this is weird, but he got such a big reputation out of doing that well that that's what made him a presidential candidate later in the 1920s.
Because he did this effectively.
Yeah. As a matter of... yeah,
saved food effectively.
He saved food out the wazoo.
Yeah.
And he was out there helping the starving people of Belgium. People recognized this as a very good job. And they actually had a catchphrase for it, which was called Hooverizing.
Oh, okay. You mean if you did this at home, if you thought about these things. Yeah.
Just the process
right.
of being really efficient was called Hooverizing mm-hmm. back then. And that's what got him into
that's
the kind White
of neat.
House.
Yeah, that's kind of a neat phrase that's been lost to history.
Yeah, that's because of the Great Depression.
Right.
And at that point, the name recognition changed, and you were talking about Hoovervilles.
Yeah.
Which are the shanty towns that you're living, like through the cardboard box
right.
down by the river.
Yeah, it's interesting, kind of similar reputation. But yeah, it turned against him at the end there, and Hoover's just not thought of as a good president.
No, he's down near the bottom, not the very right. last, but
right.
near the bottom of the list,
mm-hmm.
and that's because of the Depression. But before that, just reputation alone,
mm-hmm.
he had one of the greatest reputations going in there as one
right.
of the most able
yeah.
candidates who ever arrived at the White House.
Right.
That's true. Sugar, of course, was on that list. Wheat, meat, fats, sugar.
Yeah, eat fats. Use just enough.
Exactly.
That's what it says.
And as far as sugar is concerned, that's a little bit of a problem for us in World War I because we are an importer of sugar at that time. And you can see here that it says saving sugar saves shipping. This is another one of these messages. And it says, hey, you've got it really good compared to the people of France because they're on these really, really lean rations in the middle of this war, because they're at the wrong climate for sugar also. It says here that approximately 75% of our sugar is shipped to our shores. And once again, the U.S. Food Administration asks
mm-hmm.
each family to limit its use of sugar to 2 pounds per month per person per household use. One neat thing about World War I here is that that is voluntary. This is not the same kind of rationing system that we saw in World War II,
right.
which was mandatory and punishable
mm-hmm.
by law.
Yeah, and you could only buy so much food or certain
yeah.
types of food.
Yeah,
in
yeah.
Stores.
If you ran out of stamps, good luck.
Right.
But in this case, they didn't go quite that far, and they just had a really big propaganda push
yeah.
to just beg you to cut back on these kinds of things.
Right. And they wouldn't know exactly, too, what to do. But with the Second World War, they had this one to look back on.
Right. And say, I actually prefer this because you're not forcing
well,
it
sure.
on the population.
Right, yeah.
And they were really patriotic in World War I, so people really heeded it. In fact, there was a petition that you could sign where you're a pledge, really. You're mm-hmm. signing the pledge to save food. They put it out in the newspapers.
Oh, they print the names of people who signed?
They will. It's the form that you can send back to Washington, D.C. saying, yes, put me on the list.
Okay.
And so in that case, it's kind of, sort of an honor thing.
Yeah, and kind of builds up that patriotism collectively.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, that's exactly what it was about.
What else you got, Brent?
Next,
more
we've
food?
Got my very favorite one from this entire era. This is actually brought to us from the College of Agriculture at the University of Kentucky.
Oh, here it is. Yeah.
And this is an agricultural state at that time. So what they're telling us is dairy products as a source of nourishment, more attention than ever before. Do you know? So we can play a little game of do you know
right,
here, Jason.
Yeah.
Do you know that milk is our most perfect food? I bet you did not know that.
Really?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. According to UK College of Agriculture, this is our most perfect food, milk. Do you know that butter is our most valuable source of energy?
Ah, the butter. Yes.
Isn't that an interesting, valuable source? Yeah, what does that mean?
Right. I mean, how much butter can you possibly consume anyway?
Some people could actually consume quite a lot. I have seen fried butter at carnivals.
Yeah, I don't understand that. How does that not just disintegrate? Is it frozen?
I don't know
it's
how
it's a stick
do it.
Of butter.
Maybe it's just a miracle of food
oh,
engineering.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you know that cheese is an economical substitute for meat?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah.
Is it, though?
Yeah.
I don't know. Do you know, and I love this one.
Yeah.
That ice cream is a food, not a luxury?
Hmm.
That's going to be my new personal motto.
Right.
Ice creams are real food.
Tell
it's not dessert.
That. Yeah.
I'm doing my patriotic duty by eating ice cream.
Yeah, well, you're just having your lunch.
Yeah.
It's food.
Yeah, yeah. There's no need to save it for some special occasion. It's a real food item.
And it was cheap. It was cheaper than meat.
Got to be in World War I for sure. Speaking of things that are cold, if we look at our next item, we see ice boxes on wheels. So one of the brand new technologies of World War I is going to be refrigeration. And with refrigeration, that's actually going to turn into a big consumer trend in the 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
You'll see that the refrigerator is one of the must-have items of the Roaring Twenties. But like a lot of things, like radio, they're experimenting with it and developing it during World War I. We've got the obsession with food. You want to preserve the food.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to make it last longer, thereby increasing the food supply. And they're trying to explain to you what this is. I think that's kind of fun here.
Right. Yeah, it has a little picture of the meat hanging in the train cars.
Yeah, yeah. So they're saying, look, we've got this brand new technology. It's called refrigeration.
Mm-hmm.
And they try to explain it to you knowing what you know already, which is ice boxes. And that is literally a box full of ice
yeah.
that you used to use to keep your stuff mm-hmm. cold.
Just put a big piece of ice on it.
Yeah, but this case, we're going to go high tech with refrigeration. And it's going to lead to big implications.
It did allow for the transport of food, too. You could just keep it longer and take it further.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's what it's all about for sure. We've got a Calumet baking powder ad. Baking powder is going to help you conserve on food. It says that if you use this, then what you're doing is saving wheat during the cooking process.
Okay, so you're just extending the food. You're just adding this substance in and using less food or less
wheat. I'm not 100% sure about the science of this claim, but I guess if you use the baking powder, it rises better. You don't have to have as much of the wheat in there.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to be the claim anyway. And they're selling it using the war. Waste in the kitchen means want in the trenches.
Right.
We're selling tractors. as a new technology to help increase the food supply.
Man, you're just going nuts on these.
Of course we are.
One food thing after another, yeah.
That's because there's a food obsession, Jason.
Mm-hmm.
Food obsession in World War I.
Says a tractor sold to the farmer, $750.
Yeah, they're selling it basically at cost as their patriotic contribution to the war. They're doing their bit.
Well, you think that's really happening, though? There's got to be a little bit of money
now,
to
I
be made.
Now, I will say that in World War I,
yeah.
you've got to be careful as a businessman, because if you're accused of profiteering during that war, that's a very, very serious charge. They will bring the hammer down on you.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe I'm inclined to believe that claim. Maybe not 100%, but I'd be kind of willing to believe
right,
that claim.
And you're kind of in a tough position because you still have to sell things to people.
Oh, that's a really tough position.
And so I mean, you have to not give it away also, but also give the appearance that, you know, this is fair. This is the right thing to do.
Right. And another thing that's the right thing to do is you are helping gather up certain resources that the government needs that were food related.
Uh-huh.
Guthrie's, this is one of the stores that we had downtown, is asking you here to help save a soldier's life.
Yeah.
The government wants peach, plum, and prune stone.
What's a prune stone? Do they mean the nut?
The little seed thing down on the inside of it.
Okay.
Hickory and walnut shells.
Never heard it put that way.
Had not either. A stone. I've always called it a seed.
Yeah, it's the big seed in there.
Yeah, but they called them stones here in this particular ad. And what they're doing is the government's going to take those, grind them up, and somehow use them in the filters of gas masks.
Oh, okay.
Because World War I features a brand new horrific weapon, poison gas.
Right. Well, that's interesting
little ingredient.
Yeah, just kind of grind it up into a charcoal dust that it'll pass through.
I guess so. That scares me, though. I can't imagine poison gas on one side of the battlefield, and the only thing between it and me is a prune stone.
Yeah, it's a hickory nut.
Wow.
A prune stone.
That is the scariest kind of war, Jason. I'm telling you.
I bet little kids went around picking these things up.
They probably did because that's kind of part of doing their bit.
Forward them to the Gas Defense Division of the Army, like you said.
That's it. And another thing we've got to do as our civic duty is pay a few bills. That's another ad, of course.
Yeah.
It's bigger, it's brighter, and it's lower priced. It's Motorola Television. Just two simple controls. $169.95. Webster Radio Service, Walton, Kentucky. Let me ask you, Jason. It only has two knobs on it.
Mm-hmm. One's to get the channel, I assume, right?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Select the station.
Right. One's for volume.
Doesn't that leave a few things
right
off of the knob list that you kind of need?
How big is this screen?
That screen
doesn't. Oh, it's 10 inches.
Ten inch. That's a
sharper,
big boy.
Steadier than ever.
Yeah.
Right. I like how they have the little kind of little phrase for the antenna. It's a built-in antenna.
Oh, that's very clever.
They're getting
isn't
a little
it?
Creative with that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that was very creative. And you know what's the most creative thing? Your takeaway.
Oh, geez.
For today's lesson.
Yeah.
On the spot once again.
Well, I've enjoyed just listening to like the food, the fact that, again, we've heard about saving other things, you know, metal in particular, that kind of stuff during the wars. But food really became a factor, and it kind of, you had to imagine that this need would also change the way people ate later on. You know, once you figured this out, it just changed our diets. That would be interesting to see how all this just changed the American diet 20 years later.
Well, you're right. And sooner than that, Prohibition came out of this in part. In part.
Really?
In part, it was temperance that had been building up for all those years. But in part, it was that's wasteful. All that corn that you're turning into whiskey could be used to feed somebody. And so it really gave an impetus to it.
Yeah, that makes sense, right? Yeah. That's another argument that you can make for it. We don't hear that much, though, connected to Prohibition.
No. It's one of those hidden history sort of things. We have now turned to the final page of this chapter, but never fear. More quirky old Kentucky tales are yet to be told. Special thanks to our sound engineer Todd Birdsong, the Paducah School of Art and Design, and WKMS. And the rest is history.